Okay. I can't record from this side.
I know.
I feel less on the spot not having to look at you too, because we're using, we're not using a video interface.
Yeah, we're using our normal old-fashioned audio only.
And I feel less objectified.
Yeah, well, I mean, I see your jawline and I lose all concentration. I'm just jealous of your face. I look at myself with self-loathing. I can't concentrate on the movie. So this is probably better for us.
I think so. I think we'll both have a stronger backbone, some more self-respect. Yeah.
I feel more confident. It's hard to judge a movie when you're constantly judging yourself as you look.
It is. It's totally, yeah. I mean, you fall into a narcissistic loophole. Yeah. It's terrible.
I saw them at Lollapalooza, narcissistic loophole. how are you, buddy? Everything good?
Yeah, everything's good. I had a really nice weekend. The 4th was great. Hung out with some friends and had some great food and saw fireworks and just did the thing. It was great. How about you?
Yeah, I was. So coincidentally, the town next to me, Bristol, Rhode Island, has the oldest running 4th of July parade in the country. I don't know how or why that happened, but, you know, the country is like founded in Plymouth, Mass. But for whatever reason, this town, Bristol, Rhode Island, has the longest running consecutive 4th of July parade. It's 246 years in a row or something. So I was actually in it because of the local radio show I do here, Heather and Maddie, it's called. So Heather and I rode, we were in the parade.
God, you rode on a float and waved
yes.
at people?
Yes. Never done that.
Were you actually on a float or in a car?
Well, we were in a car. It was a Ford donated to us, a new Ford Bronco with no top, and we stood up in the back of it and could wave to people, and it said Heather Maddie on the front of it. And man, there was something like 200,000 people on the route. It's huge, dude. It's huge. And it goes, Bristol's this charming town that where they should film a lot of movies, actually. Just gorgeous. And then
they're too smart for that.
What's that?
They're too smart for
that. Yeah, exactly. As a matter of fact, no tax credits. They pay you to stay away from their lovely town.
Yeah.
But they, you know, and you're going down this really quaint, beautiful Rhode Island town, and then it just opens up at a certain point, and you're just all on the water. And I was saying to my co-host, Heather, I was like, I don't, you know, there's nothing like this in the country, in the world, you know, where you have a parade of this size, where you have this view. And it's this beautiful, like they're just, it doesn't exist. It's so, I felt so blessed. And there's the feeling, Tony, was like, it's so funny. Not to say I didn't want to do it, but it was like the 4th of July, beautiful day. And I'm like, oh, I have to report to this huge field at 8 a.m. I was kind of stressed about it. And by the time it was over, I was like, that is a life experience I will never forget. It was absolutely incredible. People just cheering and so grateful to be outside. And this thing got, you know, postponed and downsized in the last couple of years because of the pandemic. People were out in force. These people made these signs, said thank you, just constantly thank you, thank you. Of course, to our veterans and to our first responders, but also just to everyone in the parade. And I'm like, why are you thanking us? Like, we should be thanking you. You know, it was just such a, and everyone's going happy 4th and God bless America. And it was, you know, kids in red, white, and blue. It felt like, yeah, look, I mean, we know there's a lot of problems in the world and in the country, but boy, for a day, it was like an escapist film where everything was right in the world. And dude, all races, all people, all types, and just shoulder to shoulder cheering and waving and smiling. It was truly a life event that I'll never forget.
So you felt like Gordo Cooper for a day. That's amazing.
I don't know who that is.
Oh, he was an astronaut.
Oh, was that the guy who, which one was he? Cooper.
Is that Gordo Cooper's Cooper, Millions? Well, in the right stuff. I believe he was, who was he in the right? He's in the right stuff. Who was he? Oh man, I'm totally blanking.
It's okay. So basically like looking down upon the earth and going like, you know, I know there's problems down there, but it's beautiful, you know, mankind type of thing. Yes, that's exactly how I felt.
Well, I was talking about coming back and having a parade in your honor. That's what I meant.
That too. Hey, that's
I wasn't thinking that, you know, anything quite as grand as you were. I was just thinking it must have felt great to have people screaming your name and howling for your were they throwing underpants at you and stuff?
It didn't get there, but you're right. For as we said, for a narcissist who judges himself and loathes himself, it was like a fantasy. Right. It was like a fantasist piece.
Amazing. It must have been. It must have been. Gordon Cooper was played by Dennis Quaid.
Okay. Sure. And look, there's a parade thrown for me every time I walk through this front door, as you might well imagine.
Well, it's in your contract when you get to the recording studio. I know that Max and your lovely wife have to throw a bit of a parade every time you start the podcast.
They go, and they have like confetti.
Mm-hmm. Just the look of their bored faces. I would love to see that.
You know what's so funny? Speaking of like Americana and stuff, is I saw an old episode of this has been on my mind. I saw an old episode of the Andy Griffith Show, and it was called, I think it was called City Slicker. And this guy comes into Mayberry from the city, and he's like a go-getter, and he's on the move, and his car breaks down. He just can't wait to get out of Mayberry because I think you guys are too slow. You people are too slow. I got to get out of here. When can I get out of here? This backwards town. And the last scene is Andy and Barney Fife on the front porch, and they're singing an old song called like Church by the Dell or something. And they're singing it in close harmony, and the guy just kind of stops, and they go, your car's fixed. And of course he goes, I think I'll just stick around for a little while. You know, he learns the value of small town life.
Right.
But I'm going, there were so many front porches in this town of Bristol, and that community is so tight. I go, man, they had it right down south in terms of the front porch. So I mandated some front porch time in my house last night.
Ooh.
I said, we're going out to our front porch and we're just going to sit there. No phones, no nothing. And
that's pretty creepy.
It was awful.
That's pretty creepy.
No, actually it was awesome because I talked like this the whole time. And I was like, Max, bring me a grasshopper. Bring daddy a grasshopper. I heard that girl down the street. She's no good. She's causing trouble all over this town.
Sure. It was a gossip thing.
Yeah.
I understand.
It's just, but
the mandate part's a little scary, but you know, front porch sitting is not something I've ever really done.
Well, in the city, it would be the stoop, right? There's right. Something about, because we have a back deck and we have a above ground pool. There's a deck on it. We sit back there, but there's something about the evening time sitting in the front of your dwelling, be it a stoop or a porch, which is, I don't know, it felt good. And I was like, yeah, you can see your street, you see the people. I liked it. I might start doing it.
Did you finish that Andy Griffith episode? Because at the end, I remember they kill that city guy with a chainsaw and they eat him.
It ends in murder. Yeah, murder suicide pact and cannibalism. Well, golly, this guy tastes good, Andy.
The Mayberry Chainsaw Massacres.
There's only three things you need to know about the law in Mayberry. There's Andy, me, and Baby Makes Three. I remember that quote. So yeah, that was I don't know what the hell I'm talking about, but that's what a podcast is for.
You were filled with feeling and emotion.
I was.
I like that.
Hey,
good for
you. Speaking of good old American classics, let's do something we haven't done for a long time on this show, and that is the Parapost. These are the best paranormal themed posts we see during the week. We grab them, we talk about them. Let's go.
Time for this week's Parapost post.
Boy, you're catching me off guard. I don't have a post.
You don't need
I'm
it.
Sorry.
I got it.
Okay.
Well, as always, Tony, there was a lot of UFO talk this week on social media. Debates and more videos and debates about videos. And someone posted something about Joe Rogan saying he doesn't believe in all this new government disclosure. He thinks it's the government trying to cover up high-end technology that they have, which is kind of a reversal for him. But I figured, why get into those waters when really the post of the week since our last episode was friend of show and former guest of show and future guest of show, Brian Kano, paranormal investigator Brian Kano, has written a book called Grains of Sand, Tales of a Paranormal Life, available on Amazon, and it won an Indie Book Award.
Oh, wow. That's awesome.
And they tweeted that out. So you can get Grains of Sand, Brian Kano's new book, on Amazon. And it is an official award winner now. And by the way, when you look at the back cover, there are the reviews of the book, like the comments by people who are encouraging you to read it. You might recognize one Matty Blake on that back cover.
Oh, interesting. Yep. In his bio, does it say among his other accomplishments that he was a guest on our show?
It should. I don't think it does. Right? But it should.
World-renowned paranormal investigator and guest of Rated P for Paranormal.
Well, it's definitely going to be in his next bio. That's for sure. I think he might have written He might have written it before he was on the show. But other than
that. Well, we've shamed him into doing it now, yes. Haven't we? Mm-hmm.
So, well done, Brian Kano.
Good for him. That's great. Good work, Brian. Nice.
Yeah, so that made my day.
Can't wait to read
it. That made my day. And if you see anything on social media you want us to tackle, any issue or post, we will do that. Tony, we also have a lot of mail to get to, but I just want to pick a couple highlights.
Okay.
Our episode, this would be last week. Our episode from last week, we did a top three of facilities, hidden facilities or secret facilities. And Superfan Carrick said the League of Extraordinary Gentlemen facility, the lair and the factory in the middle of the frozen country of Mongolia was amazing. I never saw that.
I never did either, but I'll keep an eye out for it. That's a great call.
And our episode Splash, we blew it, man. We blew it in our top three because, as was pointed out to us by the always alert and brilliant Anna, she said, you guys missed the top three because we did top three interspecies relationships. She said, you missed Blade Runner. That's a human and an AI. And you missed Starman. And I'm like, oh, dang. And double dang. She's right. And then she said, my number three is Pam and Tommy Lee, but I might have misunderstood the assignment.
Yes. Well, okay. In our defense, and I hear you, I believe you have a point, but, hey, I'm on the fence whether I'm ready emotionally to term AI as another species. So I'm not ready for that emotionally yet. What was the other one?
Hear that, Anna? They got.
What else did we get wrong?
They got to him, Anna. They got to him.
No, I'm saying, I mean, I think that's a very interesting perspective she has. I'm not there yet. I'm not advanced enough, I guess, to think of AI as a species. Maybe I'm wrong there. I could be. What was the other one we got wrong? I'm trying to
say. She said Blade Runner and Starman.
Oh, Starman. Yeah, Starman. Yes. That's simple. I just didn't want to bring up the only time we brought up a John Carpenter movie to be the one I didn't like.
Wow.
So.
Who was Starman? Was that oh, no, I'm thinking of K-Pax.
Jeff Bridges.
Yeah, that's right.
Karen
Jeff Allen. Jeff Bridges. And then we heard from Donna in Texas. She thought we did a great job last week getting into the weeds on Stranger Things 4. And
cool.
A lot of comments on your UFO pictures, Tony. People were like, wow, that's crazy. Like, you know, people were, they were definitely moved by.
That's crazy or he's crazy? Which would they say?
You know, I don't want to delve too far into it. The word crazy was bandied about quite a bit.
It was mentioned. Him, which signifier, it doesn't matter. Him,
it's, tomato, tomato.
He is. It's crazy.
But, you know, all kidding aside, people really, you could tell they were like, wow, you know.
Nice. Yeah. I've shown it to some people, some friends of mine who I would be happy to tell me I was crazy. And they looked at it and they were like, that looks pretty interesting. I can't explain that.
Yeah. I showed it to my aforementioned radio partner, Heather, and she's not into this stuff. Particularly, like, she's not closed off or open to it. She just doesn't kind of enter her, you know, she doesn't think about it. And I showed it to her. She went, wow. Now it's funny. Oh, here's a funny thing. So my radio partner, Heather, her uncle, I guess great uncle maybe, is super famous in ufology. His name is Gersten, by the last name of Gersten. And he's in Sedona, Arizona. He's famous for, he's the first person, I believe, or one of the first, but the first notable case where he sued the government for freedom of information about UFO disclosure, like way back in the 50s or 60s. And he still gives UFO tours. He's 80 years old, but if you Google.
Because there wasn't a Freedom of Information Act in the 50s.
Right. You know, that was, I think, basically his, you know, kind of cause, like there should be something like this where we should have a right to know. You know, I should say pre-Freedom of Information Act, probably. But if you Google him, he's pretty famous in that world. Yeah. So it's kind of funny that I ended up with a radio partner with that. But I get the sense from her, I'd have to ask her directly, but I get the sense from her, it was a little intense for her as a kid having that as an uncle. And And so she kind of shies away from it a little bit. You know, she kind of just goes, oh, yeah, UFOs. I know my uncle, you know, that type of thing.
I can see that. Yeah. I mean, I certainly don't know her uncle. I know some people who get involved in this kind of thing and they get obsessed and it can be a little much. So
yeah,
I get that.
As we said last week, I can watch the people losing respect
for I have alienated everybody that I know. I understand how it works.
Alienated. Well done.
I did notice, actually, looking at it again, it's funny, those shots, one of the craft, if it is a craft, looks exactly like the shape of the gimbal UFO. And there's another one that looks exactly like the shape of the Kenneth Arnold craft.
Yeah, you're right. You're right.
I mean, literally, it's weird. It's weird. So if it's dust on the, you know, if it's actually not an object, which I find hard to believe because of the shading and all of that, it's weird that they'd be in the exact shapes of these known objects too.
And I think I originally said when you first told me about them and showed me them, I had mentioned Keksberg, the kind of bell.
Yeah, that bell shaped one. Sure, yeah, is. It's very classic.
It
yeah.
sure is. Spooky.
Yeah, no, that's cool. I was glad to share those, and you know, I'm glad people are checking them out and commenting.
That was our web person said that, you know, because they can see the numbers, and they said that by far that was our number one, you know, kind of looked at, reached
photo. Okay, so great. That's kinda cool. So basically, it's possible that I've just unleashed, you know, a horrible contagion, visual contagion on the earth unwittingly.
Well, you just marked yourself to be followed by
as if any that's new.
Louis Elizondo.
I'd love to hang out with Louis. He doesn't have to surreptitiously follow me. He can call me up. I'd hang out with him anytime.
I think that's what he does. I think he just does that.
It's a hard habit to break. Let's face it.
Good Chicago tune. Okay. Let's get to our film. And this one, we're going to take a little step back in time to the 80s again. We're going to go from Stranger Things 4 to this week. 1987's The Gate, and based on the film The Gate, tonight's top three list inspired by said gate, Tony, will be what? Our top three
holes.
I'm sorry. Could
you... Holes.
Top three holes in film history.
Top three holes in movies.
Okay. Might not want to listen to this.
That's what the producers handed me that this morning. I was shocked. I had other ideas and they were seriously into this one. So
okay, you might not want to listen to this one at work. So coming up, we'll do The Gate and the top three holes in film history. I would advise you to be careful on that Google search.
Yeah.
You are listening to the only podcast of its kind, hosted by two industry professionals. Host, actor, investigator, Maddie Blake.
I was slaying it is what I was doing.
Actor, director, filmmaker, Anthony Arkin.
I'm just saying things to get health insurance.
Two friends with a love and passion for film and the paranormal.
I'm gonna kill all of you.
Thoughtful analysis.
Insider
knowledge and intelligent conversation.
More cocaine on set. Is what I'm saying.
Find us on social media at Rated Paranormal.
Come on, kill me. Do it, I'm here.
To leave us a message, visit our homepage, anchor.fm/Rated Paranormal. Simply click message and let your voice be heard and click support to donate.
I hope you're tortured about it and that it bothers you.
Share the podcast and help grow the P4P community.
Who the hell is that? Shut the door!
Rated P for Paranormal, the best and worst of paranormal pop culture.
Boom. Tony. When Al and Glenn's parents leave town for the weekend, little Al throws a bash while Glenn and his pal Terry explore a hole in the backyard. Is this just a space left by a tree or a portal to hell? 1987's The Gate. Tony, first of all, I'm assuming that you picked this film directly in response to last week's Stranger Things season 4 review. Am I wrong or am I right?
You're 100% right.
Yeah.
You're 100% right. I picked it because I feel like it's the one movie that Stranger Things doesn't realize it stole everything from, but it did, because not that many people saw this movie.
Right.
I mean, it has a cult following. Don't get me wrong, but you know, it was a bit of a deep cut. But to me, it's incredible that it has. It's just got everything that Stranger Things is pretty much trying to do.
Yeah, it. I couldn't help but think, in a way, they're so incredible. They're like mirror images of each other, or rather, polar opposites in a way. It's the same world and things they're toiling with, but they have opposite problems and opposite awesome things about them, in a way. Like, I thought there was nothing in Stranger Things 4 that was close to as scary or as seriously paranormally handled as there was in The Gate. And yet the performances I don't know, you know, some of the things I loved about Stranger Things 4 might have been lacking in this one. So in a way, I kind of felt like they were opposite experiences, even though it's the very similar topic.
Interesting. Yeah. I mean, I feel like what's really kind of curious about him is that even though this movie is actually from the 80s, right? Mm-hmm. So it is the real thing. It's the real thing that Stranger Things is trying to imitate in a way. But this movie is also doing the same thing that Stranger Things did, because it came after Poltergeist and Phantasm and a lot of other movies that it's a reference that The Gate is referencing. Sure. So it's actually referencing some of the same stuff that Stranger Things is, but it's referencing it from like later in the 80s, which is kind of cool.
Yeah, because this is,
because there's a lot of Poltergeist in
there
this
is
movie.
The house itself is like, It reminds me of like the Poltergeist recreation you might see in like a video version if someone tried to like recreate the movie Poltergeist for a commercial or something. It's like the house has echoes of Poltergeist. The rooms do. The yard does. The neighborhood does. The first shot, he's driving his bike through the neighborhood. It's like the opening scene of Poltergeist in a lot of ways, just a little more remote maybe.
Yeah. It's also kind of like a demonic E.T., like an evil version of E.T.
Yes.
Like, and then Poltergeist and E.T. are also very similar, too. Yep. So, yeah, I mean, it has a lot of the same DNA. So it's kind of cool to see how we were kind of like fan servicing and paying homage or ripping off movies of the time at the time and how we do it later.
Amazing. Yeah, that's a great point.
Yeah. I really want people to see this movie. This one's such a you know, like I said, it's like a really deep cut. Mm-hmm. I don't, you know, you don't see it on a lot of lists or top 10 lists. Well, you see it on some lists, but it's like people like me going like, check out this Gate movie. That's not what you think.
Well, Tony and I don't talk about our reviews before we do these on purpose, but him and I, we did communicate about something else. And I said, one quick question about The Gate I have to know. It's got to have a cult following of some kind. And I just wanted you to confirm that, because what I was wondering the whole time was how, this is another one of those movies. I don't know. I think Season of the Witch did this to me too. And I'm like, how do I not know about this movie? And why isn't it talked about more? Not to say that I think it's, you know, The Shining, but man, there's a lot worse movies that I know a lot more about.
Right. Yeah, guaranteed. I mean, like for Amityville Horror, for instance.
Thank you. Yes.
As far as I know, it really does have a cult following. You know, I'm made up of people like me who kind of saw it on a surprise rental back in the day. You know, like I didn't hear about this movie. This was one of those Blockbuster moments where I was like, oh, that's a cool poster.
Yeah,
that's a cool, you know, video cover. Let's check it out. And I remember, I mean, it was 87. I wasn't a kid. I was out of high school. Yeah. But I remember really being really impressed by the special effects and the you know, how far they go with all the fantasy stuff. I was blown away.
Isn't that funny that at the time that would have been a mind blower special effect wise, you know, like you look at it now.
Well, honestly, because it was a movie I hadn't heard of,
sure,
like I was already pretty well into like who was doing effects and the big effect movies and everything. I mean, you know, The Thing had already come out and, you know, so I was just really surprised even at the time, like, why didn't this movie do better? Right. This is, you know, this has got the juice. I mean, it's really I find it full of surprises to this day. Like, I still watch it every once in a while and just be kind of like amazed at actually how spooky it gets and how some of the effects are, I mean, not even in a quaint way, because I like old fashioned effects. I know everybody knows that, but I mean, sometimes I like them because they're quaint. This is working, it's working at a level that, like, I would see that today.
Yes.
I think it's, you know.
Yeah. Like I said, there's nothing in Stranger Things season four that, and I loved it. I passed season four. There's nothing in terms of scares that's remotely as close to the scares that are in this thing. My estimation, most of those, and I think you'd agree, although we're going to agree maybe even more than you think about the special effects too, most of the effective ones aren't effects driven. They are little touches. Like, for example, when everything goes bad because of this portal where the tree used to be opens up, we've seen a family picture on the wall several times. And when things are kind of at their worst paranormally in the third act, the little boys are running down the stairs and he just glances over his shoulder and looks at the family picture. And the family's all like bloodied and mangled in the photo. Yeah. And I'm like, man, I haven't seen anything that disturbing and scary in a film in a long time.
It's really messed up.
It's odd and fast and just enough. And there's a bunch of little touches like that.
To me, when the movie takes a little bit of time to set up, but it's a short movie. It's an hour and 25 minutes long. It's a very short movie. And they take a little bit of time setting up character, which I love, you know? And the scares and the chills don't really start for almost like 35 minutes, 40 minutes, you know. I mean, the gate opens up, there's some build up, suspense stuff, but then when things really start happening, when this night of terror begins, it starts with a bang. I mean, when that kid who plays the little heavy metal kid, the friend.
Oh, yes. That is an actor named Louis Tripp. Or
Louis Tripp, who I adore in this movie. He's this little heavy metal guy. And we know that his mom died last year. We're told that. And we're told, like, there's, you know, people are like, this kid's, he's kind of messed up. He's a heavy metal kid. Watch out for him. But Stephen Dorff's dad, Glenn's dad, says, like, but he lost his mom. So, be nice to him because he's having a hard time. And that sentiment kind of amazing in a movie like this. But then when all hell breaks loose, the first thing that happens is that his dead mother comes to the door and rings the doorbell.
Yes.
And he embraces her and they rip off The Shining in the best way.
Yes.
And it turns out like he's embracing the dead dog of his friend
who wasn't dead seconds ago.
And it's really messed up. Like it's definitely more disturbing than you're anticipating in this child run, like, you know, E.T. ripoff.
Right.
Movie.
Right.
They really go there and they continue to do things like that. I don't think in a gratuitous way. I think they really are grounding it with character, you know? And we talked a little bit about that too, how to my thinking, this film makes a better case of character development and, you know, arc of story and completion of story and like a full meal in an hour and a half. And I don't think Stranger Things did that in eight episodes of, you know, in 10 hours.
What it does really intelligently is that it sets up that these things, this portal, has opened us up to demons, a demon and a bunch of other demons through this, you know, hole, this portal. And so what they follow up on and continue with is that all these things that happen are like what a demon would do to scare these kids, right? So it's the kid who just lost his mother. It's going to be an apparition of the mother and the dog, the beloved dog of the kid, and like the family picture being mangled. Like, so everyone it's very consistent in what it does and how it scares the children. The safety of, so Stephen Dorff plays the main kid, little Glenn, our hero. And of course he just, as everything is starting to go wrong while the parents are away, like any little boy, he just says, I want to call mom and dad, to the older sister.
I know. It's so adorable.
And he's like, let's just call, which by the way, is like, thank you, screenwriter, also, because that's what a kid his age would do. Wouldn't be like, let's solve this mystery. It would be like, call mommy and daddy, please. The dog died, you know, and you're seeing things, which is awesomely intelligent writing. And
it's intelligent and it's very real. I love that quality of them not trying to make all these kids too cool, you know, cooler than kids are. Right. They were very like, and it also is an interesting thing where the kid, like, there's a lot of love in the movie.
Yeah, there is.
With the characters, you know, like the friendship between the two kids is actually like a bond you think is going to last for their lifetime. And the sister and Glenn, you know, they fight, but they really love each other. Like, she buys him a present.
Yeah.
They care about each other.
Yes.
He misses his parents in a way that's actually legit. Like, you feel like the parents are actually pretty good parents, as like a lot of these movies depict dysfunctional families and broken kind of families and people and stuff. And this was really, you know, accurate in terms of like a normal, happy family. Like, it wasn't, it was kind of unique. It was strange.
And that's what makes it so disturbing and scary. And that was what I was getting to earlier when I was talking about the demon's consistency of what they would scare the kids with. Glenn just wants to call the parents. So guess what? When the parents show up, which would be his comfort, it's not his parents. You know what I'm saying?
They look like his parents, but it's
not. And that, how would you, if you were a demon, how would you scare that little kid? Well.
And how do you like the, you know, one of the most horrific gore effects with his dad.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
That basically, you know what I think they were doing? I think they were going like, an equivalent of the steak scene from Poltergeist.
Yeah. Yes. Well, hold on. The thing I thought of when his eyes start concaving was Stranger Things 4. Like, that's what he does to those kids. Their faces kind of like suck in on themselves. And I go, maybe Stranger Things 4 people saw this movie. You know, maybe the Duffer Brothers saw The Gate.
I'm sure Duffer Brothers got to it, but you know, sometime.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's disturbing again, because that's almost like you've said before, where you don't feel in safe hands watching a movie. Like, okay, the parents are home. You know, they might Dubois him now, or they might punish him now. And all of a sudden it's like, wait a second, that's not the parents. Like, everything's thrown for a loop. And then there's a phone call and it's like, okay,
right,
this has to be the parents now. It's like, you never feel safe and you feel like the kids do in that moment.
And that horrible, horrible sound it makes, that you've been bad. You know, it's just horrifying.
It's horrifying. It's so, I wish a lot of horror movies could learn a lot from this movie in terms of the simple but effective character-driven scares,
right?
That again are scarier than anything I saw in The Conjuring or anything I've seen recently.
Yeah, truly, because you know, I mean, subtly and slyly, you come to care about little Stephen Dorff. Like, he is adorable. Let's be honest. I mean,
he, you know, what reminds me of, he's like the late '80s, like the '70s version of Stephen Dorff was that little kid on Eight Is Enough.
Okay.
You know what I mean?
I don't remember, but I'll go there with you.
Little Timmy or something on Eight Is Enough. Anyway, he reminds me of that. Kind of like his size is a little stunted, so he's like wicked extra cute.
A little bit like really young Corey Haim too. Before Corey got mean.
Yeah.
And streetwise.
Yeah.
Anyway, I love Dorff in it. I know that the movie is chock full of kind of, you know, goofy 80s horror movie acting.
Adam Rich is the actor I was thinking of from Eight Is Enough. He played Little Nicholas.
Oh, Adam Rich, right.
From Eight Is Enough.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah,
doesn't he?
He's got an Adam Rich thing. He totally does. You know, I mean, But where it wins, like the kind of like funny, bad teen acting is actually just so funny and entertaining to me in this. I'm not bothered by it, particularly because I really do like Dorf and Lewis Tripp. I think they're great together and I think they're wonderful. So, and since they're in most of the movie, I don't really think of it as a poorly acted movie, but it certainly isn't, you know, as slick as Stranger Things.
Well, and that's the obvious comparison is that. And although the emotional beats and character development are as rich as the things in Stranger Things, nothing in the gate kind of put a lump in my throat or made me cry or anything like that, which Stranger Things 4 has done, for right or for wrong. I just think maybe because they have more time.
You're alone on the emotional thing with that show. I didn't have the feels for Stranger Things.
Okay, 4. That's fine. But I think these actors are a little more challenged than the cast they were able to put together as Stranger Things 4. That's just how I feel. But I also think the moments, there are significant moments in this that are awesome in terms of even that stuff. Like there's a little beat where this Lewis Tripp, who's Glenn's friend, Terry is the character's name. Terry and Glenn are friends, and Terry is the heavy metal kid. He looks like a mini version of Harry Dean Anderson. Was that his name? From Night Court. He's like round glasses and everything. And there's a beat between them where I got the sense Glenn might have been a little younger than him, even narratively, like in the script. I'm not sure. But the point is he's definitely more innocent. Glenn is more innocent than Terry. Terry's been kind of damaged, as Tony, you alluded to, with his mother's death. And he's going through something. And Glenn says something very childlike when the dog dies. And he says, well, the dog was 90 something. And Terry goes, he wasn't 90. He goes, well, in dog years he was. And he goes, you know, they don't last that long. And Terry gives him a little look like pity. And it's you're still a little kid look. And it's very subtle, but I'm like, wow, like that's that type of, there's a few of those really nuanced touches. So I'm not saying it's worse than Stranger Things 4 in terms of that stuff. I just think maybe because it was a movie and they had less time and I think some of the casting makes up for some of that stuff, but I think the attempt is there.
I'd like to pick this apart a little bit because, this gets into an area of I kind of feel like sticking up for certain things in their weight class, if that makes
sense. It totally
sense.
Does. I take that into consideration too. I know what you're saying.
I mean, you have to understand this is a low budget, movie that they made in Canada in the mid 80s. Like Canada didn't have the kind of industry that we have.
Yep.
They didn't have the kind of money or access to, Hollywood actors or any of it. They had a limited, well to draw from to make films. That's not a criticism. It's just a fact of they weren't a major player in movies at that time. They became one.
Right.
And so they got a little mini budget horror movie. That's usually going to be trash. When that movie succeeds and surprises me with things, that alone makes me emotional. Like that really gets me. And so I feel like for its weight class, for what you're normally going to get from that time period and that kind of movie, the acting is actually pretty good. Yep. At the time I remember being surprised that a movie like this that I never heard of actually had a cast that cared about the characters. It was notable at the time. So you put it up against a cast like Stranger Things, which had much more money even in the beginning and more access to, every little kid actor in America. Yeah. They didn't have that for this movie. And I just feel like noting that,
I hear you. I think that's a great point. And I can tell you how effective it was because I thought at first we hadn't spoke And in the first 5 minutes of the movie, like opening shot, I saw the interior of the house. I saw it was Stephen Dorff. I saw some of the kind of maybe less, less sexy set design, things like that. And I go, oh my God, Tony picked this as like a farce to just really like have me have a good time with like a horrible 80s Canadian horror movie. And he has a dream that turns out to be a dream about the tree. And I go, oh, that's interesting. So my expectations were not only low, I was ready for like a farce.
Exactly.
And not only was it not a farce to me, although I had a blast and there are some kind of really tongue in cheek moments, I think, but it was super effective. So yeah, I'm on your side. I shouldn't even compare it to Stranger Things 4 when I'm talking about that type of stuff.
I think it's a valid point. I just think it's interesting to talk about and like break down why, because it's one thing to be like, Stranger Things is slicker than this movie, but this movie has some good things. But that's like, you know, I just feel like stating the situation on the ground, as it were, when they made this movie and movies like it.
And I share the lump in your throat, as it were. I'm kind of using that as a
right.
I share the lump in your throat for what it is, where it came from, and how well it did. Right. I agree with that. The actual lump in my throat from watching actors act isn't here for this one, and it was for the other, I guess, is the best way I can say.
Okay. Well, I mean, look, that is what it is. Right. I did get kind of like lumpy about the dog dying and how Stephen Dorff kind of like choked it down and tried to be a man about it.
Yeah.
And that kind of got to me. And his missing his parents was like,
I felt that
fighting about calling his parents.
Yeah, like, will someone like, call the parents, please?
It was, it kind of got to me a little bit. And the overall idea for me started, I didn't get choked up, but it's a little bit sentimental in that way, in that nice way about like, you know, the movie from the beginning is really dealing with the fears that kids have about growing up.
That's it. Yep.
You know, and I gotta say, not to punch at Stranger Things, but I don't feel that level of depth from Stranger Things any season. I feel it in moments, but I don't feel an overarching thing that it's about like it is here, where it's like, oh wow, you can really see all this as a representation of the terror of crossing into being 13 years old, you know, crossing into teenage land where it's scarier and dangerous things happen. And we still are connected to our mom and dad, but we know that we shouldn't be. And it just, I think it does a really good job of playing that theme well, kind of throughout the movie. And I think that's where it has its, that's where I get emotional about it, I guess, not from any one performance or thing, but.
In my P4P training, my Jedi Knight training of watching film now, I always try to find the thing that the director might be working on at a different level. And I think this movie, for me, it came in, or one of the ways it came in was through her friends, through the older sister's friends, who almost become like a Shakespearean witch gaggle. And I think that they kind of represent what you're talking about. The bridge between a kid his age and their age was on a math table isn't that big, but in reality, in a life, it's a huge gap.
Right.
And they're all kind of children from our perspective, but to them, it's a huge difference. She's babysitting him. And the kind of evilness of her friends, I feel like kind of taps into the demonic stuff that's going on in the house, and it's kind of interrelated with it. It's interesting that the one really, truly paranormal thing that happens to him that's clearly undeniably paranormal, for the first time where it's quantified and you couldn't say it was just his imagination, happens with that gaggle of teen friends.
Right, the levitation scene.
Yes, he levitates in front of a group of kids who are basically trying to do a seance, and they go, kid, come here. And
seance like party time sale.
Yeah, but I think that was very intentional. And I think that type of thing bleeds into the metaphor that you're talking about of the subtext of what's going on here. The real demon is his fear of what the adult world is. And then when he finally gets the one thing that is safety, the adults that represent safety, even that is turned upside down. So it really does become Yeah, it's terrifying. And then the safety of his house, a child's house should be their safety, right? And there's things in the walls, literally moving inside the walls, and you never know where they're coming from. It's really effective on a bunch of levels.
I'm glad you thought so. You know, I mean, it's got, to me, has some funny lines in it too. Like, it's got such great, you know, ridiculous moments.
Yes.
I'd like to smell you when you're 97.
Yes. Amazing. It really does.
It's like the Bible for demons.
Oh yeah. His little heavy metal book. Yeah. And that whole band thing was just a really kind of, that was another thing. That the whole backstory of the band itself was, I was like, I want to, so Glenn's friend, Terry, the little heavy metal kid, kind of figures out what's going on through his fandom of a mysterious kind of cult death metal band that died under serious circumstances and left a book of incantations and spells behind. And I'm watching that little subplot of how he figured it out. And I'm comparing it to other movies that we've seen where how the protagonist figured out the mystery. And I'm like, it's completely benign and boring in those other movies. And B, I'm watching this going like, I'd like to see the film about that band now.
I know. I mean? I know.
Like,
yeah. You know, it's such a great, it's a great metal movie. It's a really true heavy metal movie, like for little kids.
Yeah.
And one of the things I love about it is that, you know, it came out, I guess, kind of after, but during the Satanic Panic, you know,
it's all over it. It's all over this movie.
And the thing I got to say that I truly adore about it is that the heavy metal kid isn't vilified in this movie for liking heavy metal.
Right.
In every other movie of its time, it's kind of the dark gateway. And in truth, that saves the day here.
Yeah. He figures it out through that.
And I love that for a lot of reasons, but I found out that the reason why that's there is because the director, Tibor Tekas, I don't think I'm pronouncing that correctly, but he is, I guess he's from Budapest. Huh. Came over to Canada and was directing stuff, directed this movie, but he was a big musician, heavy metal guy, knew all the heavy metal acts in Toronto, and was really a part of that scene. And the music in this movie from that group is quite serious.
Yeah.
It's a real group. The Killer Dwarves that's on the patch on his jacket was a real Toronto heavy metal band. It really respects it, you know, in a way that you didn't see ever in the 80s, except in, like, honestly, Phantasm.
Yeah.
And, I love that. I love that they didn't scapegoat the heavy metal kid for being into demon music or whatever they used to call
it. Well, it's interesting because for a kid who just lost his mom, you really see that it's his comfort. He puts a blanket over his head and goes in. Yes, he rocks out, but you can see so clearly the way it is shot and written that is his pacifier. You know what I mean?
Totally.
And it's actually pretty touching. And in that way, it looks completely benign, even though what he's doing is saying, you know, on the dawn of man, demons carry, whatever the song is saying, but it's like, it's touching because of what it's doing for him and how it's filmed. It's really, it is.
And they pay due respect to Venom and the other bands of their kind. And, the artwork in the album is great. You know, it really looks real. It
sure does. Like I said,
it's beautifully done.
I want to see that movie. Well, now here's the thing that you mentioned the director, and we know what Stephen Dorff became. He's become a very successful actor, but you know, I looked up Lewis Tripp. You know, he did like three kind of B horror movies, it looks like, and nothing else. You can't find anything on him. And I really can't find much about the director, although he's done a lot of things like TV and a lot of Canadian projects. I'm just marveling at where they all ended up because you know what I mean?
Well, Yeah, I mean, I marvel at it and I fear that, because it's like, you know, I feel like the people that wrote and directed and shot and created this movie and did the effects on it, the guy who did the effects has done a lot of stuff. He's very famous, yeah. In fact. And the effects in this are great. So if you like practical effects, this movie, you should see it just on that level, yes. Because it's kind of incredible what they did for $2 million. Yeah. Like it's kind of amazing.
There's a bunch of little demons that run around that,
some of the best little creatures I've ever seen.
Yeah, and it almost becomes like stop motion animation at times. And
they use that. They use everything. They use people in suits with forced perspective.
Yeah, their
they
faces. Use the faces of these little demons are so good.
And they're really creepy. Really, really creepy. The big demon is actually kind of amazing for low budget, 87. Like, oh my God. It's
now I have a question about that big demon before we wrap up here. And this is a spoiler alert. So fast forward to 15 seconds or 30 seconds if you don't want to hear this. In the final kind of climactic fight between the kid and the demon, if you will, the demon picks him up and then pats him on the head, basically. What did you make of that moment?
I got the idea that the demon was aware that he had... that this boy had let him out.
Open the portal, basically. Yeah.
And was you going to use him as a toy or a pet?
Yes. Okay. Thank you. Good. That's
maybe keep him alive, right. But use him.
Yeah. You know? Like you're not what I'm after.
That's what I thought. What did
same,
you think
same. I was like, that's the only thing I could draw a conclusion that that's the gatekeeper, if you will, you know, yeah. To put it in Ghostbusters parlance.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. Good. Yeah. Thanks. I just want to make sure I wasn't missing something like totally.
No, I get maybe we both missed it, but that's what I kind of thought. There's one shot, you know, where there's also another demonic character in the movie, which I think maybe in a way the scariest and certainly one of the best examples of this. There's a corpse that you get the feeling that maybe the whole start of this was that.
Yeah.
That one of the workmen who had built the cul-de-sac and the buildings there in that suburban community had died on the job and had been buried in one of the houses.
Yes.
And sure enough, that turns out to be true. His reveal is terrifying.
Yep.
And I have to say the makeup effects on that corpse guy are really, really messed up. I mean, that's some great work.
And what happens to poor Terry,
terrifying
how he's revealed after he gets sucked into the walls, both terrifying and funny somehow.
It's got, and it has that great energy it's fun horror.
Yeah.
It's the scariest movie for a little, like it's 100% The Shining if you were 12 years old.
And things that are just as scary in a way, like, you know, even for an adult, like again, there were some really effective scares that I wish current modern horror filmmakers, like, oh, say somebody doing the newest Halloween or whatever, would watch something like this and just, it's not that
apparently hard. The movie was originally, as written and conceived, far nastier and much more violent.
I'm sure.
Much more heavy metal, death metal vibe to it.
Sure.
But I love the guy who did the effects on it is a guy named Randall William Cook.
Okay.
Who, among other things, did the Devil Dogs in Ghostbusters.
Oh, wow. I totally see it. Yep.
Very well known.
Totally see
it. So the work is excellent. The sculptures are, the animatronics are amazing. Mm-hmm. The sculptures of these creatures are great. So much better than you think you're going to get. You know, I just love being surprised.
Mm.
Love it. Mm. What are the other little details? I'd mentioned that Tibor, the director, he's definitely in the Toronto heavy metal scene. The music for the heavy metal band, Sacrifix, is actually a thrash metal band called Sacrifice in Toronto.
No kidding.
You know, I think the only thing that probably, you know, I needs to be mentioned is that they're, you know, trigger warning, a couple of times the kids use homophobic slurs at each other.
Yeah.
Which was very common at the time among teenage kids.
Of course.
And, I wince a little bit when I hear that kind of stuff. Yeah. I don't think it means movies shouldn't be seen. I just think it's good to mention it.
Yeah.
And also in in that regard, I felt like the thing that kept it from being really rough was A, its veracity. Like, that is how little kids talk to each other then. Yeah. And also the fact that it was coming from the littlest kid seemed to me to be very pointed and on purpose. Mm. Like, in a way, maybe they knew better, like the filmmakers were kind of aware, but depicting somebody who was using this language, I don't know. It's there a couple times, so if that offends you, you know, tread with caution or whatever.
Yeah, I think it was honestly, in my opinion, of the time and place, and he was trying to capture how kids talk at that time.
Oh yeah,
quote unquote, no one would have been offended by it back then. Certainly.
Oh, certainly right? Not. It wouldn't have been on. Well, I mean, maybe you would have been offended, I guess, if you were perhaps.
That's why I said quote unquote. You know, the masses wouldn't. It wasn't a word that caused people to pass out practically. You know,
certainly not in a general social sphere. I mean, we weren't thinking about language in that way at that time, and that's a shame about the 80s, but whatever.
In its defense, it didn't mean that, because you know, it's a word that was bandied about in my circles. And we didn't even equate it. I didn't even know what that was, to tell you the truth.
I agree.
I didn't know completely. What gay was really. And it was just meant, you know, being wimpy or scared or missing the ball or something. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I that's as far as the knowledge of what that concept was for all of us at the time. I mean, you know, when you got to be an older teenager, there was little less excuse
correct.
For it. But as a, you know, 11-year-old, you really didn't understand what it meant.
Right. So I would venture to guess that was just that director going like, oh, this is what this kid would say at this moment. And they were the insults du jour. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. That's the only thing other than some just, you know, pretty horrific violence that happens that you'd be triggered by. Yeah. It's just such a surprise to see it pop out of this movie that you really think is going to be just like, oh, Tony made me see this as a joke.
Right. Which again speaks to its power, because when you go from that to where I ended up, you know, that speaks to its effectiveness. I think when
you've been bad.
Well, let's be good and vote on this and then get to our top three holes in film history. Tony, at the end of the day, the film, The Gate, is it getting a P for paranormal or a P for pass? No, thank you.
I want to give it a P for paranormal myself. I you know, there's just so many surprises in it, and I thought it handled the paranormal stuff really well. And I love this movie, so I want to give it a P for paranormal.
Agreed. There was like five different top threes I thought of based on this movie. You know, there's a point where the phone melts. After that, you've been bad line is bandied, and
great.
It's so effective. I was like, oh, top three phone moments in movies. And I thought, what was a movie reviewed with Charlie Sheen in the phone scene when she's on the phone in the kitchen and she basically gets electrocuted?
Oh, that's The Believers.
The Believers. Yeah. I was like, I thought of The Believers scene. The kind of
with Screaming Sheen.
Yeah, Screaming Sheen and like the annoying friends. I was like, top three annoying friends. But my point is, my larger point is, there was so much to sink your teeth in this movie. And non-ironically, like fun, like, oh God, you know, I just thought of so many different top threes. I'm like, that's a good sign. And when a movie is this unknown and this pleasant of an experience, it has to go on. It's as you once said on this very show a few episodes ago, if this show exists for a reason, it's to highlight movies like this
that people might get a chance to check out. Yeah.
So let's get it on there. And hopefully people will check out The Gate. And now let's check out our top three holes of all time. Tony, who would you like to begin?
I think I started last week. Why don't you go ahead?
I got to start with number three, a film that we have reviewed here on the show, because it might be one of the worst scenes I've seen in doing this podcast, thereby one of the most pleasurable and just electric scenes ever, because I was laughing so hard and just bewildered by the performance and what was going on. And that is the hole that Kevin Bacon is digging in the backyard in Stir of Echoes for an inexplicably long amount of time.
Well done. Very, right? Very well.
I mean, I won't watch that movie again. I'll watch that scene 100 times.
Okay, that's your number three. Yep. I guess my number three, I'm going to go with the crater on the asteroid in The Empire Strikes Back. Ooh. That is actually the giant Exogorth worm. Wow. With the Minox living inside.
Yeah, when that thing pops out of that, it's quite stunning.
I remember when I first saw that movie in the theater and that happened, that I that was the most exciting thing I'd ever seen in a movie at that point. Awesome. Flipped me out. So yeah,
that's not a hole you want to be in.
No.
My number two is a movie I saw recently with my wife, a surprise little find. It's on streaming services everywhere. It's called The Dig, starring Ralph Fiennes. And it's a true story about a woman whose property is discovered an ancient ship, a huge archaeological discovery at the time, perhaps the greatest archaeological discovery in England's history. And she hires Ralph Fiennes, who's an amateur archaeologist digger, to kind of, you know, uncover this thing, to dig a big hole, basically. And it's about classism and, you know, being good at your job versus the establishment who comes in and tries to take over the site. And it's all a true story. It's a touching movie. It's a great movie. It's called The Dig. And most of it takes place in a giant hole.
Sounds very adult.
It is. It's, well, I had to make up for my Stir of Echoes pick.
Yeah. It sounds too adult for me, but thank you.
You would love this movie.
I actually remember seeing trailers for it. It looked quite good.
It really
actually.
Is. I mean, you know, it's like a chamber piece. It's a lot of dialogue, but
who's the woman in it? Is
it's a great question. You go ahead with yours. I'll find her in the meantime. How about that?
Okay, because she's great.
She's awesome.
So my number two, which is going to be my number two, will be the hole in the dunes at the back of the kid's house in the original Invaders from Mars. That's absolutely terrifying to this day. The whole movie doesn't work, but when that ship crashes over the hill behind his house, it creates a hole where, you know, they climb in and find the aliens and stuff. So good. Such a classic hole. Oh my God. That's a Love
great
it.
One. That's a great one. The actress, by the way, is Carey Mulligan.
Carey Mulligan. There you go.
Okay, Tony, great number two. We're at my number one already. Boy, this is going fast. Michael Shannon and Take Shelter. He's digging a hole because of a prophetic vision he's having about the end of the world and basically putting a bulkhead over it as a shelter. And he's just slowly unraveling as the movie goes, and it ends in this climactic scene he has at a public event. And it's just this dreadful movie. I mean that in the best way. The dread just ratchets up. The tension ratchets up. Yeah, I could spend all day in that horrible hole.
Great. Great. Yeah. Mm-hmm. My number one is probably the hole I'd go into, the last hole I'd go into.
Okay.
And that's the well in the ring.
Oh, such a good one. That is such
that's,
a good one.
That's a hole I will not be investigating and will not, no thank you.
I'll tell you what, we kind of rag on modern horror, and so much of it is deserved. So much.
I don't rag on that one.
Well, I was going to say, when that creature first kind of crawls out at you, I mean, man, oh man.
So scary. So that's my... that's my number one. I do have a couple of three honorable mentions.
Yes, but I do too. And let me say one more thing. Like, how many people have ripped off the ring, that scene in the ring, since then? It's just
so many people. And with things living in the TV.
Yeah,
and with
crawling out
at you.
Totally. I mean, great pick. Yeah. I thought of Shawshank Redemption as an honorable mention. The hole in the prison cell wall that he escapes through.
That's a hole, right?
I mean, that's a hole.
Yeah. So it's the Tom and Jerry hole that they live in, the mouses live in the cartoons.
We never specified what kind of hole or where the hole was located. We're talking holes, my friend. How could I not honorable mention, nay, maybe even name the award after the money pit on Oak Island? the most expensive hole of all. Okay.
You really are kind of beholden to say that. I think it's appropriate that you do say that, and we name it that. It's perfect.
I'm beholden.
Honorable mention for me, one of them, one of my three honorable mentions, will go to a new show, an Amazon show called Outer Range, which I checked out. It's Josh Brolin's new series.
Oh, okay. Dig him.
Lily Taylor's in it. It's an interesting show. Awesome. And there's a hole in that show that is quite extraordinary.
All right.
That's a notable. But I don't want to give anything away about it because it's on right now. You have another, you want to go tit for tat on the honorable mentions or?
Those are my two main ones. Although I did mention the movie Holes, but I just thought it was too obvious of a pick. So I left it off.
Okay. Well, I'm going to do two things. I'm going to mention a movie that I haven't seen yet that is getting a lot of good press, and it's called The Hole in the Ground. Huh. And it's supposed to be scary as hell.
All right.
And I just want to see that, but I'm going to say something that's going to shame you.
Okay.
It's going to shame you, Maddie.
Uh-oh. What did I forget?
You forgot The Exorcist.
Oh my God.
Because there's a hole at the dig in
beginning.
Iraq.
And he brings head out of it. Well, I mean, that's the hole of all holes. We should name it the, you know, Max von Sydow, Ethiopian hole.
The hole of holes in the hall of holes.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's it. That's the one. Okay. That's the granddaddy. That's what you get when you win this award.
Right.
Top to you get a replica of that hole from The Exorcist.
And the movie teeth, but we won't go into that.
Okay. No, we won't. No, thank you. Well, Tony.
Great movie though. Anyway, sorry.
No, thank you for delving into those holes with me. And thank you all for joining us again. Check out The Gate next week or the week after. Not sure yet. I'm leaving day after tomorrow for another trip. But we're working on a very special, if for those of you who do watch the show or are aware of the mystery of Skinwalker Ranch, we are working on a special based on the series Skinwalker Ranch from my friends at Prometheus, which may include someone intimately involved with that show. So keep checking our socials. It'll be next week or the week after.
Right. It will be our next episode.
Correct.
Right? Whether that.
Thank you.
I hope we can get somebody to come talk to us. But even if we don't, there's so much to unpack out of that.
I think we can. You've been bad, but you've been so good.
You've been bad.
I'm doing that.
We hope you've enjoyed this edition of Rated P for Paranormal. Please rate, review, and share. It really does make a difference. For more information, to participate, and even donate, go to our main page, anchor.fm/ratedparanormal. On social media, we're at Rated Paranormal. All music is by Andrew Galdens Jr. You can find him on Instagram at KidRiga, or go to therocketscience.bandcamp.com. This podcast was created, written, produced, and edited by Maddie Blake and Anthony Arkin.
Oh, golly, this guy tastes good, Andy.
All I even needed is something like this.
I'm sorry.
Bowls.